So this morning we have with us Ms. Susan Nina Carroll of ISADAP, and I will have her introduce herself, her position.
Okay, well, I am the senior program advisor, which means that I'm a consultant working for MPRI, and I'm here on behalf of the Department of Justice ISADAP program. And what I do is I coordinate our various project components and the logistics and the administration. I'm the program manager, who's a federal employee. I'm his deputy, so to speak, and kind of do just about everything. And I've been here since July 23rd, 1997. Mm-hmm. So I have a little bit of history with the program.
It looks like it. Yes. Also, just before joining the ISADAP, what were you doing? What was your career sort of before that?
Well, I started out as a military police officer, okay? And when I got out of the Army in 1992, I went to work as the director of training for a private security company and ran their academy that they had. In 1995, I took a short contract with ISADAP to work on the Haiti project as a police trainer. And then in between that and this, I worked on in the training department of the Atlanta Committee for Olympic Games. And then when the games actually started, I took over the venue of the airport venue where the athletes were coming in. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I ran, I was in charge of that during the games, and before and after the games, I was in the training department. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and that's about it. And then following that, I came to, I did a couple short training, police training contracts for ISADAP in Croatia, and then and then came down to Bosnia. Mm-hmm. Been here ever since.
Ms. Carroll, let's see. So, do you have a specialty in police work as far as policing goes or reform goes? Anything pertaining to policing that you have a particular... So is there a niche that you work on?
Not really. I'm more of a generalist. Mm-hmm. We bring in specialists to work in those areas, but mine is more just kind of the management and... And I haven't really done policing for good 8 years, even with ISADAP. Instead, what I do is I coordinate the program itself for the boss, and have gotten away from the hands-on training aspect and development aspect of the local police. So,
well, I think the aim of the project is to get sort of a mosaic perspective, to get sort of the perspective of the players, as you say, hands-on, so people who are actually designing, planning, implementing the policing reforms, but also just people like yourself who have sort of more of a managerial kind of perspective, who are several steps away from the game itself, so to say, and once again have that kind of a vantage point. So,
well, that's good.
That's good. No,
yeah, over the years, I guess I've become more of a jack of all trades, master of none, sort of thing, yeah. So, any specialism I might have had, when I look back at it, the police techniques for combating crime have changed significantly, in 10 years. And they have to, because as a police officer, we come up against criminals who... Once we come up with a strategy of how to combat a particular type of crime, well, the criminals get smart and change their strategies. They always try to stay one step ahead of the police, and that's why a police organization has to be willing and able to change.
Right.
And of course, what we're doing here is we're implementing major changes. So it's quite the challenge. You have to be quite the change management. Or broker, let's say, a change broker, in order to make things work.
Right, and it seems like you have a sort of a long durée here.
Sure.
So you'll be able to give us that kind of a perspective, since 1997,
yes,
ma'am. So let's start with the question that has to do with recruitment. Okay. And it seems that in the past, when I ask this question, people usually look back in the history. And mm-hmm. let's see actually what kinds of answers, or how does that inspire you, this particular question? So it has to do with recruiting, helping national police services to develop viable strategies or programs. Mm-hmm. And the questions were, how do you sort out the good applicants from the less well-qualified ones? How do you develop those strategies? Mm-hmm. Or from people whose roles in the conflict were heavily politicized, mm-hmm. or who are possibly a threat to the new police services. So if you have experience in designing or overseeing a recruitment strategy, then that would be
okay. Well, and I would have to go back to the early years too for that, because their methodology for recruiting today is strongly based on that. It hasn't changed much. Mm-hmm. One of the things that there were several things that we wanted to ensure happen here. One is that the recruits that we go for we have to get a good ethnic balance, okay? Mm-hmm. So a lot of that is, where do you advertise? Which newspapers do you advertise in? Because the locals read the newspapers that are slanted towards their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. Some will pick up all three, but you're going to find the vast majority do not. They pick up the one. And in fact, they listen to those television stations, mm-hmm. and the radio stations that are ethnically biased, let's say, okay, mm-hmm. which is always a problem. But so when you're recruiting, you have to reach out to all three ethnic groups, and that means radio and newspapers that they read. And then the other thing is, you want to reach out to women, because mm-hmm. It's an all-volunteer process here. You know, before the war, they had a police high school. So when you hit like 14 years old, your parents decided whether you're going to be a police officer, or the government through some testing or whatever, or just availability. You know, some of the schools cost a little more than others, so the police were cheaper, you'd put them in there. Mm-hmm. But when you graduated from police high school, that's all you were trained for. So it was kind of predetermined. And they did not recruit women. So, you know, before the war, it was a male-dominated society. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. After the war, of course, we started introducing women. And our goal initially was to try to bring the force up to about 10%. Surprisingly, to us, although if you think about it in hindsight, look at it, it wasn't a big surprise. But the numbers of women who came out to take these jobs was above and beyond what we had hoped and expected. And but like I say, you look back on that and you realize, well, they lost a lot of men during the war.
Right.
And there was very, very high unemployment here. And the women they were looking for work. And here were jobs available, and it was being opened up to women. So they came in force, you know. We had one or two classes, police academy classes, in 90, I don't remember, I think it was 98, that were much more than 10%. They were like 30 and 40% female, the classes were. Okay, but because the overall force was certainly less than 10%, they allowed that to happen. Mm-hmm. Once you reach that 10% level, you know, they kind of leveled it off a little bit, and women started getting jobs doing other things and things like that. So it's kind of balanced out again.
Let me ask you one more thing. Just a question popped up in my mind. So you mentioned this multi-ethnic sort of dimension to advertising, and where do you advertise? But do the messages also vary from one newspaper to another? And also, so not only sort of the ethnic considerations, but also the gender considerations. So you have to actually change the recruiting invitation, message, promotion, if you will, depending on which, who are you trying to draw into the police force?
None of that was done. No, it was a standard. We've got, we're looking for police officers, you know, what the basic recruitment requirements were. You had to be a certain age, you had to have certain education, you know, these sorts of things, and physically fit. Okay, but no, it wasn't. It wasn't changed by by newspaper or directed towards any particular ethnic group or anything. It was the same message.
Okay.
So,
anything else that comes to your mind as far as recruiting goes?
Well, of course, we would get large numbers of people who would come and apply for the jobs, and then you have to start your initial screening and. And, you know, you go through and you look and there's just a bunch of them have come applied that don't even meet the minimum requirements. So they're just out of there. You know, you set those aside. And then one of the requirements was you had to be physically fit. So from that point, then we took them through medical screening and that knocked a lot of them out. And then from there, you took them to, medical and psychological screening.
And so that's done through the local health facilities,
I imagine. Yes, yes, uh-huh. And if they made it through all that, then there was a certain amount of testing that was done, written testing, and that would knock a bunch of them out because there were a lot of them that couldn't read and write well enough to be expected to, you know, make it through the academy. And the academy wasn't designed to teach them their own language and, you know, those sorts of things. It was, you have to already know these things. So we narrowed it down, and then sometimes it was hard to fill classes. I mean, we would have these large numbers of people coming and apply, but by the time you screened out from this, it was a cookie-cutter stamp template, okay? But still, by the time you screened them out of that, then you were down sometimes saying, oh, mercy, we need more, you know? And so that was another recruitment problem. We ended up running more classes in a year than we anticipated needing, and there's a cost involved in that. You add to that the fact that the Dayton Accord allowed for the existing system to remain unchanged in some areas. So what we end up with is in the RS, we had a police academy, and in the Federation, we had a police academy. They were both running basic recruit courses. Now, if you train 50 recruits or, say, 75 to 100 recruits, the cost is the same, because except for housing and meals. But, I mean, in terms of time of the instructors and the scheduling of time for the classes, it's the same. And what would happen is you've got like, you know, seven instructors tied up with a course for 50 students, and those same seven instructors could have handled 100 students, okay? So what you have to do then, because you didn't get 100 in a class, you have to run again. And both academies are doing this, this type of training. So since the very beginning, we've been pushing to get the academies to agree that one would take over basic recruit training, the other would take over specialized training, special classes in investigative techniques or crime scene management or juvenile courses on how to deal with juvenile crimes, how to deal with burglaries, how to deal with vehicle thefts. You know what I mean? There are special courses that cover all those specialty areas of investigation. Certainly war crimes and, you know, the major ones, organized crime and things like that. But they don't. They run, each academy runs these courses, so it costs twice as much to run the two academies.
I imagine that this kind of the lack of efficiency is actually politically motivated, I would imagine.
Absolutely, absolutely. Which, now, interestingly enough, When they first started the police reform discussions and processes about 3 years ago, the locals agreed that, along with police reform, they agreed to go to a state-managed education system, which means that the cost of the academies would go to the state, but primarily it would allow for this process of one to take over basic and one to they understand the need for that. They agree with that. But there's not a mechanism in place that allows them to do that right now. So along with police reform, that is one of the changes that we feel confident will happen, and that's because the locals all agree with that. You know, they want the best, and they know that the system that they have in place is not conducive to the best training and things like that. So,
but if you mind explaining one thing, how would it actually work with the, how would it be, just as far as something I picked up is that the RS police is highly centralized, mm-hmm. and in the Federation it's highly decentralized. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. would that have any effect, the fact that you have the two academies? Are the academies actually catering to these kinds of systems, or are the sort of the skills that they teach in either academy sort of interchangeable or transferable? Mm-hmm. I mean, is there mm-hmm. is the curriculum?
The curriculum's the same. That's one of our early projects, was to help them develop the curricula, and it's the same being taught at both academies. The only variance is in their blocks that have to do with the legal system, mm-hmm. okay? Because if you go to the RS Academy, well, they're teaching them what codes, what criminal codes are the numbers and everything have to do with the RS law. And in the Federation, then they go through and they learn those criminal code numbers. The crimes are the same. The code numbers may be different. I mean, but the criminal code as a whole is the same,
okay?
But it would be like going from Georgia to Alabama. Mm-hmm. You know, the crimes are basically the same, but you would just, when you're writing your report, you got to put the right numbers in there and reference the right criminal code. So, but in terms of policing techniques, exactly the same.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, the other sort of question that comes to my mind is also, I'm completely new to this mm-hmm. field, so I might be just not making any sense right now, but a lot of people were talking about the difference between the centralized versus decentralized mm-hmm. Sort of system is also having to do with the initiative, sort of, or the obviously the hierarchy of orders and so forth, but also the initiative that each individual player, police officer, may or may not have within that particular system. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this something that you think is also taught indirectly in the academies or not? Or is this something that is actually picked out in the...
No, it's more, the centralization and the decentralization is more effects at the upper levels.
Okay.
And it's political, okay? It's not the most efficient. Now, a centralized one is efficient in that if you have if the Minister of Interior wants to put more emphasis on a particular crime, okay, all he has to do is write a little directive that goes out to his five public safety centers that says, I want you to move 20% of your assets over to start concentrating on this particular crime, let's say vehicle thefts, okay? Mm-hmm. I want you to ensure that 20% of your investigative assets are working on vehicle crimes for a certain period of time, okay? He writes it once, he puts it out, it's done throughout 50% of the country, well, 48% of the country, okay? In the Federation, from canton to canton in the Federation Ministry of Interior, each one of those ministers has to decide, does he have an interest in that or not, okay? So if you have a centralized government or ministry or director of police, then it goes out and it goes across the country, and all assets all over the country now are concentrating on, you know, this particular crime, okay? But right now it's only half, and then it might be one or two in the Federation, or maybe none of them think it's a problem. So, you know, so what happens is the RS is cracking down on vehicle thefts, and all of a sudden in the Federation, all criminals go to the Federation because they can steal cars and get away with it because nobody's paying attention to it, you know? I mean, so in terms of management techniques, the centralization and the decentralization definitely has an effect. So on targeting your police services in the areas where they need to be targeted. And this ebbs and flows based on, you know, your study of crime trends and who's out there.
Ms. Carroll, let's actually move on to the issue of training and professionalization and talk about that a bit. Just your views. We're interested in any efforts to help develop training and professionalization in local and national police services. So sort of training in service as well as training prior to that. And you've been talking so far about the police academy, but also you've been also mentioning that you bring in the experts. So that, but it's something that one of the things that I see ECTAP actually does is bring in the experts for training and the identifying gaps and so forth. So if you don't mind talking a little more about training and professionalization.
Sure. Well, we concentrate, we do an assessment and we look at the kinds of crimes that are out there, and then we look at their investigators and have they had any training in a particular area. Every criminal activity has some aspect of it that is common to any other criminal activity. So you can do a basic investigator's course and gives them the basic foundation. But then beyond that, every crime has specific elements or specific things that criminals do that require additional training of police officers. Otherwise, they don't know to look for it. Okay. Again, let's take vehicle thefts. I mean, you know, a person thinks, well, somebody steals a car. What's the difference between that and, you know, any other kind of crime, okay? Well, the fact is that on a vehicle, you know, you've got to bring your people in. You have to teach them where to look for the VIN numbers, where to look for, how do you determine whether a car has been put together, you know, torn apart and put together with various pieces and things like that. You've got to know what kind of equipment would they need in order to tear a car apart and put one together, so that you can decide, you know, where to start looking for a chop shop or whatever, okay? And the other thing is, here they always used to handle vehicle crimes as an individual crime, okay? So if you caught one person who has stolen a car, they would go after and charge that person and for that crime in that car, okay? The fact that he may have stolen 10 cars and you only caught him doing one didn't matter to them. They didn't know about the other 10. They didn't really care about the other 10. They got him for this one car. They're going to try him for that car. You also have to get them to start thinking in terms of, why did that person steal that car? Was it to joyride it around, you know? Was it because he's going to keep it and drive it himself? Well, that's unlikely. Okay. Did he steal it to sell it? Okay. And if that's the case, who's buying stolen cars? And did they tell this person to go out and steal a particular kind of car, in which now you've got a conspiracy? So we have to get them to change the way they think when they approach crimes. Because they could go snatch some kid up who's driving around in a stolen car and charge him for stealing it and never even ask him, well, what were you going to do with this car? You know, so it doesn't even take them to the next person. So there's those, that kind of training. So, I mean, all the specialized training, we bring in experts in the various types of crimes in various fields and teach them the techniques. We also try to look at training in terms of all the levels, You know, you've got your basic crime, you've got your specialized crime, but you've got your management of criminal investigations. And when you're doing training in a police organization, you have to get the managers on board. You've got to have something that'll reach out to them. And in a former communist country, one of the things that we have found is that the supervisors here, they don't want to look stupid to their subordinates. You know, in the U.S., when I go into an organization and let's say that they've got some new equipment or new techniques, and I'm coming in as a supervisor, I'm going to grab somebody who understands the new equipment and new technique and say, show me this, okay? I don't feel like that makes me stupid or even look stupid in their eyes, okay? It just means that that's not something I've been exposed to and I'm going to get smart on it. Here, the leaders are like, oh, they can't ask a subordinate to teach them anything because then it means that their subordinate's smarter than they are. And they tend to generalize that thought, you know. So, like, we donated computers and we put computers on the supervisors' desks, and the application itself has a supervisor module which allows the supervisor to sit down and go in there and see how many cases were opened in a particular period of time, what kinds of cases. They can do a trend analysis over the last 30 days, how many rapes were reported, or how many domestic violence cases were opened, you know, what officers handled them, which officers have cases assigned to them, which don't. I mean, it's a supervisor's module, okay? But all when we created the application, we created it in conjunction with their IT people. Mm-hmm. You know, we had their input and we had, you know, to create this application. And it was their IT people's job to go back, set up the computers, and do the training. We'd go in there and find out the supervisors didn't even know how to turn on the computer. And we're like, well, why haven't you called your IT person, called them and said, teach me how to do this? Oh, I can't do that. Then he'll realize that I don't know how to do it. You know, I mean...
So what do you do in a situation like that? I mean, is there... Well, can you actually put them all in a room and
we've done that. We've pulled them together and done supervisor training, level training, but we have to bring our own people in to do it. We can't use theirs. Now, I can use a local who's working for us, but that's different. He's, you know, he's an ISI-TAP local, you know. Mm-hmm. but it's just, it's frustrating sometimes. And where the real problem lies is that let's say that we did that and we train all those people. Well, the first time in any one of these cantons, the supervisor leaves and is replaced with a new supervisor. It's the same problem. Well, we can't go out every time they have a personnel change and do a one-on-one training. We're not here. We're trying to put sustainable systems in place. And we go back and we tell them, you know, you've got to set up a system like an all new personnel must go through a certain amount of training, and then you run them through the various things, orientation training or that. And the next boss that comes in, he doesn't want to do that, so he does away with it, and then everybody subsequent to him never gets it, you know. So
but this kind of goes back to the issue of recruitment. I mean, but recruitment at a very high, much higher level of managers and so forth. I mean, can computer literacy be a part of the recruitment or part of the, what is it, job announcement mm-hmm, or advertisement mm-hmm. For that kind
not
of position?
Not really. No, it isn't. And but what you're starting to see is, we've been here 10 years, we're starting to see the beginnings of the generational change. And when you go into a post-conflict country and you are working and introducing change, it is, you're going to really start seeing the true benefits of that after about three generations. 10 years is not long enough, okay? We're just now starting to see the first real generational change. And what I mean by that is those people that we put through the basic recruit course in 97, when they came out of that training, they were smarter, they were more up to date in modern policing techniques than their bosses. They didn't get to practice any of those because their bosses wouldn't handle the change. Okay? And their bosses say, well, we know what you learned, but I don't like that. We're going to do it the way we've always done it. Okay? But they've been exposed to it, and they, as they start growing up through the system and they start taking over as managers, and then we're reinforcing with managerial training, and they look back and say, oh yeah, I learned about that, and that is a good idea, they're more likely to institute the changes, okay? And the next group coming up is even more likely to institute changes because they will have been, you know, they will have seen some of that happening. So it is generational, these changes. And like I say, we're starting to see you have to have patience. Because we pulled in the managers and we taught them all this stuff. And many of them were, I mean, they just don't handle change well, you know. Mm-hmm. Your younger recruits do. And you can't, in the early years, you couldn't choose the managers from anything other than the pool you had available. Okay? So, and many of them are, dinosaurs. That's what they are, you know, in terms of old policing methodologies and new policing methodologies. Serve the state and serve the citizen. It's a philosophical change, but it's a big one. And all the new recruits coming through are eager to serve the citizens, but some of their bosses still, you know, I mean, they're uncomfortable because they've served the state their whole life, but the state's not there right now anymore, you know. Mm. It's all the citizens are putting these demands on them, and they don't deal with it well.
That's interesting. Also, just you sort of brought out a few examples of the trainings, mm-hmm. Training programs. Are there any more that are curious or interesting?
Major favorite? Change is the training methodology. When I first got here, I went to an academy class. It was a basic class. It was being taught by a professor, well educated. He had a doctorate degree. Okay, and he had never been a police officer, but he went to police high school, he went into police college, he became a police college professor, okay? He has written books, highly educated. You know, I mean, no fault whatsoever in terms of his extensive knowledge of police theory. Okay, but for him to try to go out on the street and do anything, he'd have been an abysmal failure, okay, because he had no practical experience. And even in his book, he wrote a book on theory. It wasn't a book of how to do, really a hands-on how to do. He would sit in the front of this basic recruit class with his book in front of him, and he would read to them out of his book. Now, one thing we did learn is the Bosnians are they're very good learners through the spoken word. And, you know, I'm a very visual person. I got to have pictures, and I got to, you know, and touchy-feely, I got to be able to do it. The major change that we did is we introduced the adult learning method here, which is you tell them what you're going to tell them, you show them how to do it, and then you make them do it themselves. They practice it until they get it right. Once they've got it right, then they graduate, okay? And these professors were like, oh, you know, they could tell students that when you arrest somebody, you need to handcuff them, okay, let's say. But none of them knew how to put a set of handcuffs on. They didn't know how to do that. They had never physically practiced it themselves. Your forensic guy may come in and say, you know, today we're going to lift fingerprints. And he would stand in the front of the class and he would lift a fingerprint for them. Okay? That would be the class. They'd go, ooh. And he'd leave. Not a one of those people knew how to lift a fingerprint. They'd seen it happen. Okay? our classes, we come in, we bring all the fingerprint powder, you know, everything. We have them stick fingerprints on pieces of tape and wood, and even show them how to lift it off of a body, you know, I mean, different surfaces. We give them all the little powders. We give them the super glue. We do all this stuff. And they run little labs where they practice lifting fingerprints, preserving and lifting fingerprints. By the time they come out, they can go to any robbery or break-in and lift a fingerprint themselves right there, you know. Mm-hmm. But more than that, even if that's not their job and they're not going to lift them, they know how to keep other people from smudging it up before the technicians get there to lift it. So you can tell them you preserved the scene till you're blue in the face, but until they actually see why it's important to preserve the scene, what kinds of things you're preserving, then, you know, it's lost. Mm-hmm. So introducing the adult learning method of training and practical exercise, practical, you know, just practice, 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 mm-hmm. That was a major change in the way they do business here. And, I mean, maybe I'm bragging a little bit, but I think ISETAP does that best because I've even, you know, we check out our European European partners. They bring in training. And they do some practical exercise, but a lot of their practical exercises are still paper-based. And ours are, you know, like I say, they're hands-on. We give them the stuff. And then when they leave the class, we also donate enough supplies so that when they go back, they can get started using it on a daily basis so they don't automatically forget the skill. So, you know, that's a major change.
Interesting. So the method, teaching method.
Absolutely. Mm.
So, Ms. Carol, perhaps we could move on to a question of integration and amalgamation. Is that something you'd be interested in talking about?
Ask me the question, we'll see.
Let's see. So the question is about the integration or mm-hmm. integrating and amalgamating different types of security forces mm-hmm. or police services into a coherent police unit. And the questions here are from different contexts, not necessarily from Bosnian situation, but the situation is when you have several police forces in a country, as well as private militias and armed wings attached to big men and political figures. Mm-hmm. And then sort of the efforts to make a coherent police mm-hmm. service out mm-hmm. of those. If any of this is applicable to Bosnia, and if you have any personal experiences with it.
Well, I'll give you one example that mm-hmm. A success story, and that is it's actually a success story on the part of the European police mission. They have formulated a police steering board, and what it does is it brings the leaders of all the various police agencies together in a room to sit and talk about stuff. I mean, you know, crimes, but organization issues, recruiting issues, anything that if one agency is having a problem with something, you can automatically assume that others are. So what you do is you bring those kinds of things to the table. They discuss around and come up with common solutions. And that getting them to the table in some sort of an organized fashion with like an agenda of things to discuss where they can prepare when they come of how are they dealing with it or what are their problems. That is an ideal way of dealing with that. And the EUPM here, the European Police Mission, has actually been doing that for about a year or so, and it has truly helped streamline police services in a lot of ways.
So you're actually talking about a fairly contemporary historical moment in mm-hmm. in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. So you're talking when not necessarily back in the history in 1996 when you had a task of sort of putting together a coherent police mm-hmm. force or service out of all of those people running around in different uniforms mm-hmm. and so forth. Mm-hmm. But you're talking more about this present situation when you have when you have a fragmented sort of phase mm-hmm. of the police service mm-hmm. and sort of the integration process as a process of bringing together these units that are part of the police service into sort of at the negotiating table or even at...
Yes, yeah. Well, I tell you, in the early years, the thing is everything we introduced here, we did it 13 times.
Right.
Okay, so, and I guess the international community just kind of hoped that they would start working together. And they did. I mean, the Bosniak cantons sitting next to each other, you know, were sharing information. And if a crime happened in Travnik and traveled to Sarajevo, the police would call each other and, you know, say, all right, so-and-so's headed your way, catch them, you know, force. And they'd hand them back over to local jurisdiction. I mean, there were all those things were going on here, but there it was more ethnically based, it was more politically based, and it was just criminal based and, you know, common sense sort of thing. Common sense was not something that was common here. So then out of need, they started, as time progressed, they started doing these little agreements between cantons and agreements between the entities. They wrote formal agreements to fight crime together. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. They did that on their own. In practice, it didn't work all that well, but they at least agreed to do it. And then it came down to what criminal were they after. If it was just some normal citizen who's committed a crime, there's no problem catching them and handing them over to your neighboring jurisdiction. If it was somebody who was significant, had money, had influence, or whatever, then there was a problem. There was always a problem, you know, but again, it was all politically based. So over the years, it grew up out of that to now this level of real cooperation, let's say, and coordination. Now, they don't always agree. Mm-hmm. You get them in this room, and they don't always agree on things. But one of the early agreements that they made in terms of how the group would work was that they agreed to disagree. If there was a particular point that they could not come to a consensus on, they just set it aside, didn't worry about it because there were plenty of others to deal with and that time was limited. So, you know, so that they would constantly move forward as opposed to getting stuck on some little thing and, you know, stagnating the entire process. They just say, all right, we can't agree on that, set it aside, and they'd start moving on forward again on the things they could agree on.
But even this, it seems, becomes a question, sort of a strategic question. Which mm-hmm. room do you bring them in? Which mm-hmm. negotiating table? Where is it located? I mean, can these 13 different parties, can they agree? And is that also, does that become politically significant where do they actually meet? Or is that running overboard?
Right now, they all meet over the EUPM building.
Aha. Uh-huh. So it is
sort of EUPM brokered and brings them to the table. So they are meeting in a neutral territory. You're absolutely right. We introduced a number of years ago, ICTAP introduced the Professional Standards Association. It was when we first created their internal affairs units, Professional Standards Units. You know, I know Jim was telling you about them. When we first created those, We started bringing together the chiefs of the units from all over the country together in these monthly meetings. And what we did is we hosted the first one, and then we asked for one of the agencies to volunteer to do the next one. And then we came up with a schedule, and they started moving around the country. When it got to the RS, it kind of got... not intentionally, but it got off track. Because when it got to the RS and it was their turn, they decided that they wanted to do more. They wanted to do this regional meeting. Mm-hmm. So not only did we have everybody from Bosnia, but they also invited people from Croatia, Serbia, Montenegro, and Albania. Which, on the surface and initially when they came up with that idea, everybody was excited about it. And there was some good that came out of that meeting. But then the next meeting was scheduled for Albania, okay? Which meant all that Bosnia could send would be one or two representatives. And it never really got back to within Bosnia these meetings? Okay. So it never really got back to these regular meetings. But it didn't necessarily have to, because by that time the police as a whole here had started to mesh together a little better. We started having other, you know, ways of getting them together and things like that. So, but it, I looking back, I mean, it kind of got us off track. And then one of the countries, I don't remember which one, and I wouldn't say it if I did, but one of the countries, it was their turn to host it. And they didn't. They never got around to it. Everybody kept saying, when are you going to do it? Well, we are. But they never did. And so those meetings stopped happening as well, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. Shame. Ms. Carol, let's move on to a next question. I'm actually skipping a few questions to get to a question that looks exciting, and it has to do with the reform process.
Mm-hmm.
Exciting or frustrating, depending on a particular interlocutor, but a complex question in either case. And the question that has to do with the reform process as a whole, not mm-hmm. necessarily having to do with the most recent sort of suggestions. And in it, it has built in a couple of points, or rather invitations for a suggestion, for an advice actually, from sort of advice embedded in your own positionality and mm-hmm. in your own sort of career, life, work history.
Mm-hmm.
And so let me just sort of read off the script, and then we'll get to that particular point, that invitation for your own sort of reflection on what could be done.
Okay.
So let's see. I can come to grips with the question. It says, it is very rarely the case that personnel have all the skills they need to carry out their jobs effectively and support the process of change. In this imperfect world, do you have advice about the sequence of steps reformers should follow?
Mm-hmm.
Are there some tasks that just have to be done before others? So it's basically, I mean, the conversation has to do with the broader challenges that often affect efforts to build or reform institutions. In this case, we're obviously talking about police services, mm-hmm. policing reform in general. So sort of a hierarchy of steps.
Yeah, that is an interesting question. I would say, first of all, you would need to, you want to make sure you have the right people at the table, okay? And then the people that can actually make decisions. You know, you don't let them send a representative who's going to sit there and say, well, I can't make a decision. I can't, you know, I have to go back and tell my boss. Because the boss is never going to get the full story, the full discussion that went on about a particular topic. So you have to get the principals at the table. And then you run into the issue of training, skill levels, and things like that. So what you need to do is to walk them through where do they want to go. Don't worry about where are they, where have they been, but what does an ideal police service look like in their minds? And you have to have a facilitator there who is going to just get them talking and start putting points up, stick them all over the wall, whatever. And this comes out of my training background, you can tell, but you know, stick all their ideas up of what elements make up a good police service, you know. A solid budget, you know, the right people, well-trained people, good equipment. And then a philosophy of how to approach policing and dealing with the civilians that they're supposed to be protecting, in how to police your own. But you start putting all those ideas up and you get them to agree on them. Then you help them develop a mission statement, how to get, you know, what does this look like? What's the vision of the ideal police, you know, organization? Once you've got that and it's up there and it's always in front of them in any subsequent meetings, and you get them every day, you know, you bring them together, you kind of touch base on this is where we're headed. And then you start talking about where are we? Not how we're going to, but where are we? And you get them to draw a picture of how they do their business now. From there, then you start getting them to move from point A to point C by, you know, route B. And whenever you have any disagreements, just like those meetings I was telling you about that the UPM's running right now, anytime you get an agreement from them, you write that down as this is the reform that we're going to institute. This is the way we're going to go on this particular topic, okay? Mm-hmm. And then you go back to the table and you keep talking, and pretty soon you've got a whole bunch of things that you agree on, you know? You've got a whole bunch that there's so much discussion and they're not sure how to get there and they're just not sure what the problem is and they don't agree on, you know, ways of resolving them. You never attack them, but you just shelve them, okay? You say, all right, well, let's not deal with that right now. Let's go on to what can we agree on. Once you've got a good agreement, you formalize that right then and there, okay? And you put it in writing, put it in law, you do whatever you can with those things that they've already agreed to. Then you're well on your way to police reform, okay? They start implementing that. And then you're going to find that they're going to go back, and as these changes start being implemented, they're going to find that the disagreements they have on the other things are going to fade somewhat. I mean, there's some things they're never going to agree on, you know, and that's okay. But if you can get them to change the things they do agree on, that's a major step forward. And right now they're not doing that either, because nobody's saying, well, all right, y'all agree that the education system should be changed. Let's change it. Doesn't affect anything else, you know. The forensics, y'all agree that something needs to be done, and we kind of have an agreement how to do that. Let's do it. And then we'll worry about all everything else later, you know. And step by step.
Ms. Gale, I have one more question, actually, that before I pose it. So basically, you've just outlined sort of your vision of the sequencing starts with bringing together people who can make decisions to begin with, and then starting actually with some sort of an ideal of model of starting of what is ahead, what is the aim, and then sort of building up to that.
Sure.
And so my question is also this aim, this model of what police service is going to be, what is it going to look like? I mean, is there some work to be done for the right model even to be posed? Because supposedly these people are working with different models. Some models they brought with their most recent war experience. Some models hark back to the old system, the socialist Yugoslav system of policing and so forth. And then you also have all sorts of international sort of participants.
Influences.
Exactly. Yes. So, I mean, this model, I mean, you have the group of people sitting at a table and so forth, and then you have this model in the distance on the horizon or on a blackboard. But then, I mean, wasn't there some construction going into even putting together a viable or a different model?
Well, there's a lot of discussion that has to go into what does the ideal police department look like to you, okay? And they all have to agree on that, absolutely. And you're going to get all those influence. But let's see if I can break it down for you. How can you get to where you're going if you don't know where you're going is at? Okay? With all the influences, the international community, look at the EU. Okay? They have agreed to form the EU. None of them police the same way. They're all different. And they're all here helping Bosnia. You know, the United States is here. We don't police the same way within the United States, from state to state, you know, municipality to municipality. But we're here, you know, assisting the Bosnians. So what you've got to do is you've got to get the people of that country, the one that you're developing, to sit down and, using all those influence, still come up with what is their vision of the ideal police state, okay? The organization, the end result. What are they trying to accomplish? And you can do that. Once you get that group together to decide what it should look like and what it should be able to accomplish, then and it's going to have all those influence. But that's why I say you write it down, and everything they agree on, you lock it in stone. And then, you know, I mean, the biggest failure is not to, in terms of police reform, is not to pin down the things they agree on. It's almost like, well, if they agree on it, it's not important here. They they bypass it, okay? And so that everybody concentrates on what they don't agree on. And I think that's a major mistake. You know, you can't move forward that way. Instead, you take your successes and you build on your successes. Well, you have to know what they are and you have to, you know, formalize those.
So. Ms. Carol, thank you so very much for your insights.
If I was God, you know.
Next life, maybe.
That's right.
Next reform process. Thank you very much.